This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
Hi, thanks for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today a special guest is Jim Brown. Jim's career began in 1983, wow, selling new homes for several years, then owning a new home sales and marketing company that specialized in selling standing inventory for banks and savings and loans, selling homes that other companies could not sell. He entered into Corona area in 1998, sold 55 homes his first year. As the market changed, Jim adapted and learned to sell short sales, bank-owned properties, and also has extensive experience in dealing with land. In 2004, Jim launched a very successful Keller Williams in Corona with the largest number of agents in the area, showed a profit right off the bat, and you now have over 200 agents?
Over 350.
Over 350 agents. I've been in your building. How did that fit, man?
Well, they're not all there at once. It's okay. kind of like a gymnasium, you know?
Yeah.
If everybody showed up at once, we'd be crowded. But we have 27,500 square feet in our office.
I guess the first question is, you know, a lot of people find it very difficult to be successful at this business. So why are you successful, first of all, as a person? And then why are you able to own such a successful franchise that's really a dominant player in our area?
I guess there's a lot of ways to look at it. I think that, Keller Williams has a lot to do with that. I'd like to take all the credit, but they're now the number one company in the country.
Okay.
Actually, probably the world. But not all offices are the same, even under the same franchise. I think we're successful. One, we're in a great area, and I think we treat people well. Our what we call value proposition is I'll put it like this. I've been a salesman my entire life.
Okay.
And so I want to be in a place, and I wanted to create an atmosphere in a place that is a place I would be proud of and that I'd want to work. And so we spend a little more money than most offices do. We have a very nice office, a nice place to be. Like I said, it's 27,500 feet, so it's a lot of burden and overhead there. But we treat the people well. We try to be incredibly fair with everything. And we actually have live training literally every day, as well as everything else as far as recorded information and things like that.
Okay.
And several people available at any time for the agents that are unsure of something or they have a question. They have four or five people with more than 30 years experience that they can call at any time.
So out of all these agents, what percentage of them do 80% of the business, to what you say?
To do 80% of the business, probably 15% of the agents.
Okay. So what do they do differently?
They work.
They work hard.
Yeah, that's the secret sauce right there. You know, as you mentioned, I did 55 sales my first year. What it doesn't say is that I worked 80 to 100 hours a week. I had come, back when I met you, back around 1990, I believe.
Yeah.
Things were going really good. Shortly after that, everything went to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah, that was a very tough time.
And so I learned how to live on very little. For a while, most of my friends lost everything that they had. And at that time, I wasn't a realtor then. I was I was licensed, but I didn't work as a realtor. And then I wandered around for a while and ended up going, God, I guess I'm going to be a realtor. I had the license, so I just walked into a place. I didn't know what a lot of business was or a little for a realtor to do. And I just walked in and I said, I'm looking for a job. And oddly enough, they hired me, which I have since learned really all you need is a pulse. And
give you a shot.
And they'll give you a shot at it, yeah. But I just, the market was pretty good in 98, like that.
Yeah.
So I just worked and worked and worked and worked. And so very quickly I figured out what made money and what didn't. I made most of my money just doing open houses and working off of that. And then all of my experiences and other experiences taught people who've got in my office, we share that information. I know a lot of places you go, they everybody's very secret.
Right.
And
so you have a collective pool of knowledge that helps everybody.
Yeah, everybody at any time.
That's
there's
very
plenty
cool.
Of, there's plenty of business for everybody. And those that want to work and do it. I mean, there's some people that have shocked me that they did so well. And there's some people that shocked me with all the, just the way they are, that they don't do anything. And the difference is how much effort and intent they put into the business.
Okay. I just want to ask about your sales background. When you were growing up, I'm always interested. I introduced a guy, I used to sell electrical stuff to him. And we've just been friends for years, and we've done some real estate stuff together. But he was always so entrepreneurial. And I said, what was your first sales gig? He says, I sold manure door to door. I saw my grandparents have to buy a big bag of manure, and they only use like 1/10 of it. So he actually put little bags of manure together, sold it door to door so people could put their... And he made enough money as a, like an 6-year-old.
Yeah, you find a need and you fill it.
Yeah, so that was crazy. Well,
my story's a little different. My father was much older. He was 65 when I was born.
Oh wow! Okay.
Okay, and so he passed away when I was 9.
Okay.
And I really didn't know him well, but my mom hadn't been working. She went to work at Thrifty Drugstore, and I have had a job since I was in the 5th grade.
Wow.
And, I mean, I have never not worked since I was in the 5th grade. So, first job was a paper route.
Okay.
And I got a paper route with the Herald Examiner, and they said, here's your route area, and here's the 3 people that are currently taking the paper there. So my job was to fill that area up. So I had to go, I went door-to-door to sell newspaper to get them to subscribe.
Right.
And... the biggest memory I have of that is the cost was $1.90 a month for the newspaper.
Yeah.
People would give me $2 and they wanted their 10 cents change. I'm thinking, God, I put it on your porch and you can't give me the dime. But that was my first experience then. And I worked 36 hours a week while I went to high school selling shoes.
Okay.
Hardy Shoes in the West Covina Plaza.
Okay.
And
was that on commission?
$1.05 an hour plus 8 cents for every pair of shoes I sold.
Now, how do you remember this? This must be either a bad memory or it's a really good one.
I did that for a long time. I did that for 4 years of high school, so I remember it pretty well. And I will also tell you that though I worked 36 hours a week and most of the full-time people were working 60 hours a week, I outsold every one of them every month. I always did.
Okay. Are you a book reader or are you just, where's the gift?
I do read some. It just makes sense to me. You just treat people the way you want to be treated.
Okay. You know, it's kind of funny. I have, my best friend is a guy named Alex Navarro, best salesman I've ever known in my life. He could not train anybody how to sell, but it's inherent in his DNA somehow. He's Cuban and he loves people. And he's able to garner the most ridiculous support for the most amazing things. It's like he gets people to be on his team willingly.
Yeah.
And they go do it together. And it's like, yeah, I've never seen anybody. And that's starting with confrontation. So I've watched this guy in a matter of a minute turn ridiculous results just because he's able to get them on his side. It's pretty cool to watch. So well,
I think I can tell you what he's doing. First off, he's treating people with respect,
which
wouldn't it be a better society if everybody did?
Okay, man.
And second off, in doing that, he makes people trust him. And
yes.
And that's, I think, an ability that I have. And people say, well, how do you do that? And I go, it's really easy. You just be trustworthy.
Yeah. And you know what? That does come across. It does. There's people... I know in the house buying business, that was my greatest strength, that I would tell them the truth. You know,
if they like it or not, yeah.
Well, but sometimes I would say, you don't need to sell it to someone like me. You could list it with a Jim Brown. Mm-hmm. And then if they fought back, it would be a reason that wasn't in the numbers. It was a desire they didn't want. So then I would end up buying that house. But I always felt like I could tell that I took the risk to give the house back, and there was an element of trust that was created because they realized, okay, it wasn't just there for me. And that is a good lesson to learn. And now,
I tell all of our agents, never do anything that is not in your client's best interest.
Well, that's,
if it means money to you or not, I say if you want to, if you want to be in it for the short term, go for the money. If you want to actually make a career of this, do what's right for your clients. It'll pay off.
Yeah. Well, you know what? You showed me some charts where you're the dominant player in an area, and you just completely explained why, because that's how you build lifelong clients.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't lose that category because somebody else puts it on sale, right?
It's not always about the money.
No. No, it's about trust. You're making these guys, you know, that have homes, they don't go through 50 homes a year. They go through one home in eight.
Yeah.
And they have a pretty good memory of who took care of them. So, and I would imagine a lot of referral business because of that reputation happens. It has to.
Mm-hmm.
That's very cool. Alex has a son named David, who has followed in his foot tracks in an amazing way with the character and everything. But I saw it at age 3. He was playing with his brother. I'll tell you the story just because it's interesting that it was in the DNA. Playing with his brother, he wanted his brother's toy. His brother was physically bigger. He couldn't physically take it. So all of a sudden, there was a light switch went on, and David started playing with his toy, the one he had, and having a ball with it. And within 30 seconds, the exchange was made, because he made his toy look very attractive. I went, oh, my God, I got to tell Alex what I just saw. That was amazing. You probably remember our first transaction, actually, in way back in 1990, because I had some custom homes that wouldn't sell, and I was in the boat with a lot of people.
Beautiful homes, too.
Yeah, and you came with an offer at a $450,000 appraisal on a 60-foot teak yacht. And when I read it, I remember thinking, and I said it out loud, I think this will work. And you were, I'm surprised you even understood the offer. That was the comment that you made. Well,
things were a little looser back then. And we did back then, is one of the things you mentioned is we sold things for banks that other offices could or other people couldn't sell.
Yeah.
And the way you do that is you get kind of creative. You could be a little more creative than you can now. There's too many regulations.
It's kind of funny that my second question to that, would the transaction work today? Would a lender accept a boat as a down payment for two custom homes?
And maybe if it was private money, but you're not going to get a bank committee to do that.
Okay.
Well, I've done deals over the years with Australian Opals and Kubota tractors and waterbeds and just, you know, where there's a will, there's a way to make it work. You just have to think a little outside the box sometimes. Yeah. But it's gotten much more regulated. And in the last 20 years, I haven't really done much of that because it hasn't been needed.
No.
Money's been pretty easy.
That's right. Yeah. I'm going to ask you to describe 2020 as far as the year. But I want you to first tell me how 2019 was as somebody that owns a big real estate company.
Well, 2019 was I'd have to say a good year. Let me pull up some numbers here. Let's go. Listings sold. Here's a good one. Contracts written. In 2019, we increased over 2018 by 13.8% in number of contracts written.
Okay.
And it's going to be very similar in contracts closed. So 19 was a good year. 20 started off with a bang.
Right.
And then this COVID thing has kind of slowed us down a little bit. But, I've got a tremendous overhead with 27,500 feet and a lot of employees.
Yeah.
So I've got to tell you, March, I was scared to death, because the overhead that I carry could kill you in a fairly short period of time.
Right.
So I can't tell you how pleased I am that our people got very creative. A lot of them started doing virtual open houses. They had amazing videos made showing the houses, and we were. I'll put it like this: was absolutely shocked me. We haven't been in the red at all this year. Not at all.
Wow.
In this month, June, I think we're going to be last year.
An amazing statement, actually.
Yeah, we've done well. I can give you the exact numbers month for month. And The month of May is the worst one where we were off 38% from last year, but we're only for the entire year this year we're only 6% behind 2019.
That's unbelievable.
That's what you have when you have well-trained good people.
That's unbelievable, because you look at the car stats. I wasn't expecting those stats coming out of your mouth, to be honest with you, because you look at the car stats and you just look at sales at, like, year over year, we're down in the ballpark of 45-50%.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's an understandable. What's the mood of the seller right now, as far as did you see a lot of people pull their listing just put a hold? That's what I thought.
A lot of people pulled their listings. As a matter of fact, the biggest problem we have right this moment is lack of inventory. And because of that, you're seeing prices go up, which I honestly thought, and everybody I've talked to said, prices are going to drop. They're not. They're over last year, they're up 7.8%.
Okay.
In our greater area.
For me, that's what I pay attention to. I really kind of played that scenario out. The thing that causes, and this is my opinion, that causes like a major price change is that you have to have a lot of competition from have to sell owners.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so foreclosures. Well, there's no mood to foreclose on anybody, right? I mean, it's kind of a moratorium on people that aren't making their payment.
We're actually starting to see a little bit of foreclosure, but not enough to make a difference to us.
Yeah, when you're talking about you're going from this to this.
Oh, yeah.
Instead of, like the 90s, you were in the market, or the 80s even, so you got this crazy interest rate. And you had a 10% unemployment. The REOs got to 25% of the marketplace,
mm-hmm.
And the median price never went down between 80 and 85, which is all really odd when you think about the stats that was there.
Well, again, back then we got creative.
You could also take over loans without
qualifying. The very first house that I ever sold was in Rancho Palos Verdes, and I remember it was the interest rate was 23%, and that was amazing. So we got creative, went to the bank, several companies that had this track of houses to sell, and they were just still sitting there. They'd been through three or four different brokers, and they hadn't sold any of them. And everybody kept telling them lower the price, lower the price, lower the price. And these were homes that were owned by American Savings and Loan, I remember. And so we finally got an interview with them. We went in and surveyed the situation and went to them and said, okay, we can sell these, but we want to raise the price. I'm trying to remember what we raised. I think we raised them. They were about $500,000 home, which is a lot back then. And,
right.
And we said, we want to raise them $50,000 in price. Now, what a lot of people may not understand is new homes set their own values as soon as you, back then at least, when you had three or four sales, then in fact you set your own comps.
That's right.
So we went in and we raised the price $50,000, and the bank's going, well, we're going to make that much more money, and we go, no.
We're going to pay it in points.
We're going to buy down loans, we're going to do different things, and we did things like, they bought the house and it came with a new car in the garage.
Okay.
You gave allowances for draperies and landscape and this.
Now, what year was
everything.
This?
80s? That would have been 1982. 1982 or 1983, somewhere around there.
And you just got started.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, honestly, you're just one of those people that I think are extremely creative, that, because that's not a normal transaction somebody just starting their business would think of.
Well, I in that business, I had a partner, and he was very experienced in new homes.
Okay.
And I'd like to tell you that was all my idea, but it was mostly, as a matter of fact, him. That's Pat O'Brien.
Okay. Yeah, he's creative too.
Yeah, he's creative to the crazy extent. Yeah.
What about the mood of the buyers in 2020?
I think a lot of people are saying, "I better buy a house now because the interest rates are so low." The sellers are a little, they don't know. Most of them don't realize what they've got, or they think that it might be difficult to sell. Because if you listen to the media, they kept telling you things are going to crash, things are going to go down, this is terrible. But And as you mentioned, a lot of people pull their houses off the market in March. But the mood of the seller is, you know, a lot of them, you know, after spending a couple of months in a house with somebody, they realize their house isn't big enough. So they want to change. So I think that's the attitude going right now. Is they, a lot of people think it's the right time to move up.
Okay. And that was the next question.
And feel free to call me if you want to. So
the biggest question I had kind of was, what does the seller of a Riverside house, where do they go? Are they staying or leaving or moving up or what?
Two things. In my experience over the last several years, this has been going on. If they're tied to the area, they move up. If they possibly can, they move out of California. You know, if you're close to retirement or you're going to retire, or if you have a job that you can move, you know, that you can, you know, the company will let you move to. I think half my past clients are in Arizona and Texas, so that's that happens a lot. Also, seeing a lot of movement towards Tennessee, North Carolina, South Carolina.
Do you see that increasing, and what's the reason for it? Is it a math function, or?
It's both. It's a math function, and it's a political function.
Okay.
A lot of people are very tired of the traffic, tired of the taxes, tired of the way the government, I don't want to get real political, but a lot of people are very tired of
concerned about some of the things,
the way things are going.
Okay. Yeah. That makes perfect sense. Okay. The buyer, Riverside's sort of a, I don't, what percentage of people are, let's say 35 and under? I don't really know. But is the Inland Empire affordable for somebody that's 35 and under? Is that typical still okay at the interest rates that we got?
God, see, when you say 35 and under,
I'm trying to pick somebody that might actually be married.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I'm at an age where almost everybody seems like a kid to me.
Yeah.
So I sold a house last week. It's supposed to close on the 15th of July. The house sold for basically $2.4 million. The kid's 32 years old, makes $300,000 a month.
A month?
A month. And I'm looking at this kid going, where did I go wrong? Obviously, I'm not doing something right. And then you talk to a lot of 35-year-olds that are 32-year-olds that are still living at home.
Right.
And we see, you know, I don't know about you, but when I was 18, I was ready to go.
Yeah. I was married at 17, so I had to go.
Yeah, well, then, but, you know, how ambitious are you? There's a lot of income out there for the people that are ambitious. There's always going to be the majority of people that they think that life is, you know, life's a map that they're stuck on. They're stuck on this road, and this is all that they're worth and all that they can get. You've been in my office. We have a couple of huge signs that say "Think Bigger." Because it's there. It always will be, and it always has been.
Right.
You just have to decide you're worth it and that you deserve it, and that then you have to work your butt off to go get it.
Yeah.
We have a lot of people. We hire the newer agents that are, because we have the best training around, so we do get a lot of new agents. Some of them, I've had people that started with this, and they make $500,000 their first year. That's unusual, but it certainly happened. We have a lot of people that it's like, you know, I've got my license. Where's this business? Why hasn't it fallen on me?
Mm-hmm.
And, well, you know, it's just not going to work out. Go get your job at Walmart or wherever it is that you want to do. But if you're not willing to, you've got to push that limit, and you've got to know that you're worth it. And I think self-image is the biggest factor, and so we work on that with our people a lot. But it just depends on if that drive is there. I'll take drive over intelligence any day.
Me too. Well, it's interesting you said, because a lot of your business came from open houses,
mm-hmm.
but that's not a given, because a lot of times you know, the people are there eating cookies, you know, a look at the house. You're capturing them as a client and taking them to, they're not likely to buy that open house.
Not often. Right. It happens, but not often.
But you're taking them to the next house.
It's learning. I think I was good at this, and we try to point this out, how to figure it out. But I would say that in an open house situation, in less than 2 minutes, I can tell you if the person's a buyer or not. You know, is it a neighbor that wants to see how it's decorated, or is it a buyer, a legitimate buyer? And if they were buying a house, they were buying it with me. I had to capture them. So you would learn to capture it first, to identify it and to capture it, and then to learn that if they're not really a buyer and you're spending too much time with them, you've got to learn how to fire a client.
Right.
And you can be very nice about it, or you can hand them off to somebody else, or you can, a lot of things, but time's all you got. So to me, this is back then, and I'm not going to tell you I want my agents to think this way, but a buyer to me was somebody who wanted to buy a house today. A seller, somebody who wants to sell their house today. Everybody else would go into a different file, and it was all right with me if somebody else dealt with them. If somebody else had put them in their thing and they have their monthly reminders and the call, that wasn't me.
In 1980, first time I've ever was a realtor, I was really got hired as a buyer. I had a real estate license. And we bought too many houses for the company to deal with, so I had to hold open houses to try and sell houses. So that's my first experience ever with a customer in my car. So I'm driving to Riverside. They told me what they wanted. We had four or five that matched it, so I showed them all. Get back, and this was Friday, and I don't work on weekends, okay? So she said, well, what time tomorrow? I said, yeah, I'm not going to work on Saturday or Sunday. And what you said you wanted, I showed you the inventory we have, so it's not one of those. It's not going to work. So I went back inside, and 5 minutes later, they came in and said, "We'll take number four." Mm-hmm. And I thought, "Okay, was that a close? I didn't know."
Well,
that
yes,
was a
you
close.
Did. What you, it's called takeaway.
Takeaway.
It's the takeaway close. What I would tell people back when I was hustling, doing all that, is, and I tell my clients this, my agents this all the time, it is absolutely key to know the inventory. You've got to know what's out there. And I would tell people, look, one of the advantages of working with me is I do this every day, and I do this a long time every day, so I know what's out there. I'm going to show you the three best houses for what you've told me you want, because I know where they are.
Mm-hmm.
And I would tell them that one of the advantages of working with me, for every minute you spend with me, you'd have wasted an hour with somebody else. So I would take them out, and I would show them the three best deals for what they told me,
mm-hmm.
which, and believe me, people don't always know what they really want.
Right.
But for what they told me, these are the three best deals. And then I'd say, which one do you want? Kind of like what you did.
Yeah.
And they'd say, well, we need to see more houses. Because some people just think, well, I can't just buy the first one I saw.
Like buying.
But
it's like going shoe shopping with your wife. She buys the first pair she saw. After 10 other stores.
Yeah, I told you that I sold shoes for 4 years.
Yes.
Yeah, I sold men's shoes for 4 years. I sold women's shoes for 3 weeks. I just said, no, this isn't working.
You can't close the deal.
No, a guy will come in and go, I want this style and this style. And they try them on, they buy it, they walk out.
Right.
The women will try on the entire store, and then they leave.
Yeah.
It's like, that's not working.
My only open house ever held, because I haven't done the realtor hat. I've been on the buyer side. I had an open house one time. A lady comes in, and I had fixed the house, and I was sitting there. She said, well, we really like to have a 9-foot ceiling. I said, well, it's very unlikely to get one.
Hey, you're being honest with them.
I don't think I sold that house, but that was also the last open house because I don't have patience. It's funny, you know, how I'm built is like I used to wholesale houses. I like people to deal with numbers. Okay, I've got this 200 grand house tied up for 110. I'm going to flip it for 125. It needs this much work. Yes or no? Done. You know, that's the kind of side I want on, mm-hmm. you know, just, and when you get somebody that's like that, it's repetitive business.
Like
yeah.
Tell me what you want. Okay, I know where it is. This is what you can do, and boom.
Yeah, once trust is established, that makes it really easier. Stephen Covey. Mm-hmm. In that book, the low cost of high trust, and it's extremely important. Or the high cost of low trust. That's a very painful thing to have as a business owner.
Well, that's what happens when you don't tell people the truth.
Absolutely.
You don't do things, and it's not just telling them the truth. It's you've got to do things in their best interest.
Yeah.
Now, I've had people buy things that I didn't think they should buy, and I would generally tell them that, or I didn't think it was the best value on the market. But my job is to tell them that they can buy whatever they want to buy. It's their money.
The Norris Group originates and services loans in California and Florida under California DRE License 01219911, Florida Mortgage Lender License 1577, and NMLS License 1623669. For more information on hard money lending, go to thenorrisgroup.com and click the Hard Money tab.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.